You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, February 26th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me, as always, are the skeptical rogues, Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, do you guys remember what took place on February 24th and 25th in 1942?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm pretty sure I wasn't born yet.
Was that the Operation Doolittle?
Oh, close. Steve could probably help you.
I totally forgot this until I just stumbled upon it. The Battle of Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
What?
Didn't the Schmengi brothers have something to do with that?
There were unidentified flying objects hovering not far, or a few miles off the coast of Los Angeles. And, you know, obviously this was just after we entered the Second World War, and a barrage of artillery took place that whole night in which they were shooting at, you know, objects they had no idea. They thought it was possibly a Japanese attack on the mainland.
Did we win?
Oh, of course we won.
And what was it?
Oh.
Well, long story short, although it's not 100% determined what it actually was, The most believable theory is that it was weather balloons, meteorological balloons that were
like
known to have been released over
balloons?
Los Angeles around that time. However, the skeptical part of this is that there was a document sent by General Marshall to President Roosevelt saying that the Army had supposedly recovered an unconventional craft, recovered an unidentified airplane off the coast of California with no bearing on conventional explanation. And they thought it was possibly of interplanetary origin.
Huh.
And I thought this was also interesting because this is obviously pre-Roswell. You know, Roswell is kind of the moment in which the UFO craze hit the culture. And this took place 5 years before that.
So did they actually shoot the balloons down?
Yeah, well, that's just it. I mean, apparently not. They missed. They totally missed their targets.
Wow.
And it was interesting because we spoke about on 5x5 this week, misidentifying objects, you know, in the sky, natural phenomenon for UFOs. So I wonder if anyone ever thought that this is perhaps, you know, a natural weather phenomenon that was going on. It was described as several lights, often, you know, up high in the, you know, in relatively high in the atmosphere.
Could have been.
You know, that kind of like dancing, almost like candles, which is kind of what the weather phenomenon, the sprites that we spoke about. Were. So it very well could have even been just a natural phenomenon, not even weather balloons.
Yeah.
So the Battle of Los Angeles, 1942, this week.
So did we win?
It was a tie.
It was a tie, yeah. They were a little trigger happy back then, I guess.
Just a little itchy, yeah.
Well, it was a tight time. I mean, look at what was going on, you know?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it was just a couple months right after.
We got sneak attacks.
Right after we got Pearl Harbored.
And you know,
as they say,
we got lucky. That could have been a hell of a lot worse for the United States. You know, a lot of our ships just happened to not be in the harbor right then.
Especially the carriers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to request that we not get into a military history conversation.
Oh, okay. Typical
as
girl.
All right. That would be.
All right.
I'm a girl. Let's talk about cosmetics and douche.
Yeah.
Why don't we talk about snowflakes
and rainbows? Okay.
No, seriously. I want to talk about snowflakes.
Oh, yeah, tell us about snowflakes.
Tell us about the virtual snowflakes.
Shirley.
Hey, now. Come
don't
on.
Call him Shirley.
This was interesting. Mathematicians David Griffith and Janko Grabner, they can make snowflakes. Isn't that cool? But they're not paper cutouts or grown in their lab freezer. These are actually elaborate computer models that they designed that really almost perfectly replicate the complex growth of snow crystals in nature. It's actually taken 4 years. Apparently, this wasn't a simple endeavor at all. It's taken them 4 years to actually get this thing to work, and they can reproduce pretty much all of nature's snowflake types in incredible detail. One little tidbit that I found interesting was that nobody had really ever done this before. Nobody has been able to accurately simulate their growth until now. Their paper's being released in the Physical Review E, where they talk about the underlying theory and the computations. And apparently it was so intensive that Griffith calls it, he said that it was right on the edge of feasibility I'm not sure exactly what that means, but apparently the computations are fiendishly complex. It actually takes them a day to grow these things.
Really? So it's not going to be a screensaver that you're going to be able to download.
No, yeah. unless you're running, you know, a teraflop supercomputer.
Yeah, wait a minute though. I mean, you could,
which I am.
You could have a screensaver of an
pre-rendered. Yeah,
pre-rendered. You know, it wouldn't be the actual, yeah. And it wouldn't have like the Mandelbrot quality of an enormous amount of depth or infinite depth either.
Well, right? No, not like that. They're not fractal or self-similar, but. But the fidelity is so high that the details are so incredible that there's little things that you could see that real snowflakes have that other simulations never had, I believe, such as tiny ridges that run along the arms of the snowflake, and there's these weird circular markings on the surface that his algorithms replicate.
So, Bob, do you have a sense of what was the difficulty in doing this? Was it understanding the physical processes that were occurring in the formation of the crystals, or was it just the figuring out the mathematical end of it, mathematically modeling what was happening?
Perhaps it was a combination. Think about what you're trying to duplicate here. I mean, we're talking about approximately a quintillion molecules that make up a typical snowflake. I mean, that's a lot of molecules. And you've got all these different variables depending on temperature and humidity and local conditions. And that's why, what's that, the expression that no two snowflakes are alike? I mean, that might not be explicitly true, but it's true enough because there's so many different ways that a snowflake can form.
I have a couple questions, Bob. It just occurred to me that all snowflakes have six arms. You know, by looking at this detailed picture of the snowflake, I'm seeing how they all look the same. Now, are each one of those identical to one another?
Oh, each arm?
Yeah.
Yeah, because when you cut it out and unfold it, they all share the arms.
So the answer.
Yeah, but why would they? My question is, why would they look so alike at all? Like, because
why would there be symmetry among the six arms, if you will,
right,
of the snowflake?
Yeah, like does it turn out that way? Why wouldn't they just all be random crystallization?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. I know that there's six. Each snowflake has six arms because of it's basically the shape of the water molecule itself and the way they aggregate on each other. And that because of that is why you've got that kind of six-fold symmetry. But why the arms are so similar? Now, not in all of them, but I know what you're saying. Especially the example they used in the article. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. What I was able to find is that, first of all, as Bob alluded to, not all snowflakes are symmetrical. There is a lot of asymmetry within snowflakes. Perfectly symmetrical snowflakes are actually the exception, not the rule. And that the answer to the symmetry is basically just that the six arms, while forming independently, are all forming under the same conditions. So they're being driven by those same variables that Bob was talking about. Well, let's move on from snowflakes to sex.
Wow.
A natural segue.
Way to plow on through.
It's a perfectly natural
segue. See, it's funny because they both involve plowing.
That's true.
And six arms.
I don't know who you're having sex with.
Oh, Evan, you've done it again.
I know Evan said something really funny and I missed it because he's like a ninja jokester.
He is. He's a master of the joke bomb. You speak in, you plant it, you run away.
Not always funny, but often timely.
He's also the Popeye of our podcast.
You know what? It's funny often enough to work.
Steve, must you bait me?
He's a master baiter.
Steve, the first thing I noticed about this article that we're covering right now is that there's a picture of fish humping balloons.
I have no idea what that picture is supposed
to be.
What
the F?
Yeah, it is a little out of context.
It says balloon lumpfish attach themselves to balloons at the Epson Shingawa Aqua Stadium. Well, try to say that drunk. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Well, I'm not drunk. Wait a minute.
the deep sea fish have ventral sucker discs, which help them to cling to rocks in the water. It's a good picture. It's a unique picture.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Colorful.
Yeah. I have no idea what it has to do with the story, except that there's fish. But Well, the story is about how old sex is phylogenetically. It turns out it's much older than we thought. And this is not just referring to sexual reproduction, but actual sex. Obviously, sexual reproduction predated sex itself, meaning that the thinking is in primitive fish, for example, they would release the sperm and the eggs into the water, and the gametes would fertilize there in the open water. So the fish didn't actually have to have sex with each other. They would just release their gametes into the water. Some fish still mate that way today. The question is, at what point did the first animals start to actually, you know, copulate, you know, where the semen was injected into the female? And what we have now is evidence that pushes that date back farther into the past. That's a common thing to happen in paleontology because we date the first whatever by the oldest example of it that we have in the fossil record or in the evidence that we have. So there's always the potential that that's going to be pushed back further the next time somebody finds yet an older example. What they have here are fossil placoderms, which are extinct shark-like species. And they say they almost missed this one because there's essentially a tiny embryo inside a female specimen. And at first they thought that the tiny embryo was actually the last meal of the fossilized specimen.
The last thing it ate.
But it turns out it was its little baby. So obviously if the baby's inside in the appropriate place, then that means that that's where it was fertilized and therefore sex. There's one other piece of suggestive evidence, and that is that the species also has a modification of the pelvic fin on the belly of the adult fish, which is similar to an adaptation that sharks have that's used in mating. So while that's circumstantial, because certainly it could have been a pre-adaptation, it could have been adapted for something else that was then just later adapted by shark ancestors for mating, the fact that they have it at least is suggestive that maybe they were too using it for copulation. So,
sexy.
Yep. Absolutely.
And for the record, you know, it's not like I see a lot of headlines saying that this is the origin of sex, which isn't true. It's the first instance of mating in vertebrates, not necessarily.
Yes. It's the oldest example so far of vertebrates in the fossil record.
Right.
Certainly not necessarily the common ancestor of all sexual reproduction. No.
They specifically mentioned jawed vertebrates in this article.
That's right.
Jaws are important.
I don't understand the significance of jawed vertebrates.
Well, that's one of the first, you know, branching points in vertebrates, you know, jawed vertebrates versus vertebrates that don't have jaws.
I see.
It's just a phylogenetic distinction.
I wonder what that first fish that had sex thought. It's like, boy, this is a keeper.
Woohoo!
This is a keeper. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, I have a question about that, Steve. So you think you go into the Wayback Machine, and you think,
yes.
Okay, so at some point, two fish had to have sex with each other, right?
Right.
So
right.
Something was being inserted into another thing. Right, don't laugh. I'm yeah. conducting
so
science
sexy.
Right now. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what, you know, the first fish has to have something like a penis that goes into the female fish's vagina, right?
Yeah, so whatever the male fish was using to release its sperm into the water, he said, hey, maybe I should put this closer to, you know, the part of the female where the eggs come out of. And eventually it got really close.
Yeah, but what I'm saying,
of course, once they hit upon that, the advantage, the obvious advantage
basically
to that,
just described my junior high school experience.
The obvious advantage of that is that the sperm and the eggs are now in a very small contained space where they have access to each other. They're not being spread throughout the water. They're not going to be vulnerable. So there are other obvious advantages to that. And it probably was already a positively reinforced behavior because it leads directly to reproduction. And you know, once you head down that path, it's easy to imagine how sex would have evolved out of that.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, you know, it had to be really fortuitous to have two of the animals to have the equipment to actually pull it off that first time or that first, you know, 100,000 times or whatever.
Right. But again, I imagine the first time was just putting the
by
the,
accident.
Yeah, just putting the two those two parts of the anatomy close to each other. They weren't. They clearly were not modified for that. But also, again, you can go. You can appeal to pre-adaptation, where species of fish evolved anatomical structures which were not designed to have sex, but were designed to whatever facilitate the process of expelling sperm or eggs or whatever, and that just happened to be suitable, you know, for insertion, and there you go.
Yeah. And from that moment forward, it was punctuated equilibrium. You know what I'm talking about?
Right. So interesting. I imagine this, you know, this. There's still a lot to be learned about this, and the state will probably be pushed back further. You know, 380 million years ago, that's going back a long ways. You know, the Cambrian explosion was about 550 to 580 right. million years ago. So it's still 200 million years after that, after the development of multicellular life. Well, we have a couple of – actually, we have three quirky news items to talk about tonight. The first one I have titled The Revenge of Titanoboa, which I blogged about earlier in the week. So you guys remember the story about Titanoboa from last week, which is one of those
and actually, one of the silliest things I ever read.
Even before we get to the news item, can I issue a quick correction from that episode?
Yes.
I made an offhand joke about there being an Anaconda 3 in production based upon this news story. Someone informed me, in fact, my friend Josh informed me that there already is an Anaconda 3, and it stars David Hasselhoff.
Wonderful. How did we miss that?
How did that go by without us knowing about it?
I am so sorry that I missed that. I'd like to apologize to all of our listeners.
And to David Hasselhoff.
it co-stars John Rhys-Davies. So.
Oh, cool.
I'm so
sorry I missed that.
Wow, they must have paid a lot of money for those guys.
And many fans were shocked to find out that went straight to DVD.
Shocked
and appalled.
Right. However, if you recall, a week ago on Science or Fiction, we talked about the discovery of Titanoboa, a 45-foot boa that lived about 100 million years ago in the warm tropics of South America. And that is the largest snake to have ever lived discovered so far. The largest living snake is about 33 feet long. It's a python, about 33 feet long. So this was longer still. Now, floating around the internet earlier in the week was a picture of a river winding its way through a jungle kind of forested area, and in the middle of the river is what appears to be a giant snake. Now, there's no obvious scale given on the picture, but if those things are trees that we're seeing, then that snake, the article that accompanied it said that the snake was 100 feet long, but I think it would probably have to be significantly bigger than that.
Oh, it would be as big as a train, I would think.
Yeah.
I mean,
it looks
just
like little broccoli, those trees.
Describe the picture to our listeners. We're looking down on top of like that typical scene where you see a twisting river going through a forest. So the forest that's alongside the river is like just a big mass of green. So the trees, these are huge trees we're talking about, and they just look like shrubs from this angle. You know, they just look. So if that thing actually were the size depicted of it swimming in the water, it would be, you know, four or 500 yards long. Easily.
Yeah, gigantic. So it's clearly not real. I mean, that's the bottom line. But it's always interesting to try to figure out all the ways in which you can argue for its plausibility or whether or not it is real. One of the points I made was that, remember with the Titanoboa story, the scientists had to speculate about how it could have gotten as big as 45 feet, that it must have been warmer back then because the creature was probably cold-blooded.
More oxygen, yep.
Et cetera. So if they were struggling to explain a 45-foot snake, I doubt there's a 100 to 200-foot snake out there today.
And in a body of water like this, Steve. I mean, look at the thing. I mean, you know, proportionally, it has nowhere to go practically. How could something that large be in this size river? Impossible.
Right, right. I mean, what would the thing eat?
No plausibility here whatsoever.
Yeah, it's too gigantic. I mean, you know, what would the thing feed on? Why hasn't 200-foot-long shed snakeskin ever been found?
Right.
Or just a single vertebra, you know, would certainly tell the tale. it would be very difficult. This is in a river in Borneo, by the way. So even accounting for a certain amount of remoteness, to have a breeding population of a creature this big, it would have to have a vast range. And it's not the kind of thing you would keep hidden for any significant length of time. Other big red flags. This was a photo submitted anonymously, and it's a single photo. There were actually two separate photos taken at different places at different times, but there's no series of photos. Now, if you're, as the story goes, this is a guy in a helicopter investigating for, you know, flood situations, and you see this thing, you're going to snap one picture? No, you're going to take 100 pictures of this thing.
Yeah, no kidding.
And why the anonymity? But that's very typical of, I just faked a photo and I'm going to try to see how much play I can get out of it. You know, one photo anonymously submitted. That's
right.
Very typical.
Right. It's much, much more difficult to fake, say, 50 photos. If somebody pulled that off, that would be a titanic effort. And it would, lend credibility to the fact that, hey, maybe there is something here.
Well, that's not to say that they couldn't do it, though. I mean, if someone really put the time and effort in, they could perpetuate a hoax pretty well.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. A single photo or two photos?
It's a red flag.
Not a chance.
No. The prevailing opinion on the interwebbies is that this is a Photoshop job.
Yeah, and I'd say it is.
Yeah,
and not. I don't even think it's a great Photoshop job.
Yeah, yeah. But it got around in the news media. What was it? The Sun or something? That the Mail Online ran the story, but I'm sure a lot of other outlets did as well.
We'll hang this one right next to the photo of the Bigfoot suit from last summer.
Right. Not quite that bad, but this one was just a Photoshop. There's another picture going around the internet. This one, I don't think – this one was not faked. This was a misidentification, probably, of just a photographic artifact. And this represents a new class of phenomena, Google Earth phenomena. So the Google Earth is the application where – you can download the app on your computer, and then you can look at the Earth and zoom way in, and it's basically a composite of the surface of the Earth from satellite photos and surveillance photos and radar and other photographs, and it's really cool. And of course, the first thing everybody does is they find their house, right? And yes, you almost certainly can do that. I mean, you can zoom and write it onto your backyard with Google Earth.
I went to Disney World first.
Yeah. it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Actually, we've been using it with my daughters to teach them geography and stuff, because you could look at the whole Earth and see where things are. It's a globe. It's a virtual globe, but with detail all the way down to the ground. So people are now scouring remote parts of the Earth on Google Earth, and whenever they find something anomalous, they'd say, "Hey, look, I found whatever." In this case, someone claims that they found Atlantis by looking at Google Earth. Now, what the picture shows is a map of the seafloor. This is in the Atlantic to the west of the African coast. It's actually in a place that you could interpret, Plato's writing about the famed city of Atlantis. He said it was essentially beyond the cliffs of Gibraltar. So it could be in this relative part of the world, but that statement's also pretty vague.
Plato wasn't making it all up as an obvious fairy tale, which Plato clearly admitted was made up.
Yeah,
just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah, exactly. The quick backstory on why there's any attempt at finding Atlantis is folly is that Plato used it as a device to discuss what would happen if you have a conflict between the pure, virtuous Athenian city and the evil empire, which is what Atlantis was. Atlantis wasn't this advanced, glorious city. It was just this evil, barbaric empire. Yeah, it was a metaphor. And
Steve, what are you saying?
And he said it was thousands of years in the past for him. There was no reason why he, of all people, would know about this. There was no reaction to him actually making a claim among his contemporaries. It's silliness. And, of course, there's no evidence of anything that could be Atlantis.
Oh, come on. There's plenty of evidence.
But this guy, Bernie Bamford, who's an aeronautical engineer, right? So he must know what he's talking about. From Chester, UK, says that this looks like a grid pattern on the floor of the ocean, that this could be like the layout of a city, and that this is therefore Atlantis, because it's kind of in the right place.
And it wasn't just this guy's testimony or whatever that really sold this as obviously being Atlantis, but the Sun, the UK's paper of record, actually had an article on the sidebar written by Plato, the dead philosopher in question. So you know that it must be true. And also
Absolutely.
They had a photo of Patrick Duffy.
Mm-hmm. And his leg.
It's true. I'm not even making that up. People, go look at it. I'm not making it up.
All right. So, Steve, I got a few questions for you.
Yeah.
All right. One of them is, obviously, what made the lines?
Well, that's a good question. So Google later said, oh, by the way, we know what made these lines. This is an artifact of radar mapping. So if you have a boat that's mapping an area by sailing in a grid pattern, that it leaves behind this streak artifact in the path that the boat takes. And these things are actually all over the place. So it's not a coincidence that it was in this one location. This kind of radar mapping artifact you could see in many different locations.
Yeah, you can scroll the Google map up a few miles and see more of it. And you know, if you look at the main Sun article, they don't initially they don't give a link or anything to the Google map, which, you know, is pretty telling.
And, of course, an aeronautical engineer would know this, right?
Right.
Yeah, but, Steve, I'm seeing a face in the pattern of those lines.
And that, you're seeing a little
Jesus?
Bit of pareidolia?
Yeah, and that cannot be a coincidence.
No.
One thing, it's interesting that so Bernie characterized these lines as, quote-unquote, perfect. But if you look at it, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not perfect. Now, clearly, there are some that are pretty much at right angles. I agree that it's enough of a grid pattern that it's not a natural feature, that the right angles are too artificial. But to say that it's perfect is just simply not accurate. It is does look like the path a boat could feasibly take if it were, you know, doing a mapping grid pattern and with a little bit of variation that you would expect in the path of a boat. But it's certainly not perfect. Interestingly, the article quoted a Atlantis expert, Dr. Charles Orser, curator of the historical archaeology at New York State University, told The Sun, that originally ran the story, "This site is one of the most prominent places for the proposed location of Atlantis as described by Plato. Even if it turns out to be geographical, it definitely deserves a closer look." Now, before you think that this guy's being a jerk, he actually left a comment. That guy left a comment, Charles Orser left a comment on my blog. And I blogged about it, and he says, "When I was originally asked by the Sun reporter to comment on the photo, I told her that it looked like an artifact of the mapping. Unfortunately, she didn't put that into the article.
Whoa.
I'm glad that Google said as much. For the record, I do not believe that Atlantis was a real place that can be found in the Atlantic Ocean."
Thank you.
Man. Right.
So he was...
Wow, talk about a total misquote.
Right, right.
Jeez.
And you always have to take that into consideration when you hear some expert saying really ridiculous, stupid stuff that the reporter could be completely putting them out of context and abusing them. That happens quite frequently.
Indeed.
So.
Wonderful.
And Rebecca, you blogged about the third crazy news item that we
Yeah,
had
can we
week.
Bust on the Sun just a little bit more? Because I honestly think that they're becoming, they're like the British version of the Weekly World News, but with boobies.
Well, it is low-hanging fruit, but go ahead.
Okay, so there was an article recently in the Sun, and it said that a cat boy has stunned medics with his ability to see in pitch black with eyes that glow in the dark. And, you know, it was basically, it was like it might as well have been painted on the side of a wagon in like carnival letters. Like, I can't believe this is considered journalism. But supposedly, a man brought his son into a hospital and claimed that his son's crazy blue eyes that glowed in the dark gave him the power of this superior night vision, and he could read in pitch blackness, and also he could still see in perfect daylight. And I read this and I immediately thought, no, that's probably all made up.
That's like the old blindsight claims that crop up every now and then. People claim they could see even when they're blindfolded.
Yeah, except for that one we covered in Science or Fiction a few weeks ago, which was true.
Right.
but yeah, in this case, it certainly struck me as suspicious, and so I looked into it a bit, and I've come to the conclusion that it's totally bogus. But, you know, listeners, you can look into this yourself and see. For my part, the first thing, you know, claiming that a kid has glow-in-the-dark cat eyes, you know, if you know anything about how a cat's eye has evolved to be completely different from a human eye, then you realize that they're different not in just that cats can see better in the dark, but that the ways in which their eyes allow them to see in the dark also makes it more difficult for them to see, for instance, vibrant colors or to see detail. They also have problems with depth of field, which means that they can only focus on things that are a very specific distance from their eyes, while human eyes can adapt to different distances. You can see close up, you can see far away. So it's kind of ridiculous to say that a kid suddenly has cat eyes and can see in the dark and both as well as, you know, in the sunlight. And then it gets even more ridiculous when the sun really presents no evidence at all. There's no photo of the crazy glowing eyes. There's no name of the hospital he was at or the name of the doctors that supposedly had him read in total darkness. Instead, what they say is, and I'm quoting from the article, "Experts believe he was born with a rare condition called leucodermia, which has left his eyes with less protective pigment and more sensitive to light." Now, I'm no ophthalmologist or whatever.
Optometrist.
Optometrist, is that the right one? I always get those
ophthalmologist
confused.
Is better. Ophthalmologists are right MDs, one. Optometrists are not.
That's the one I was going for. Yeah, so I was right. Ophthalmologist. Shut up, Evan.
Yeah.
I know. So I'm no ophthalmologist, but I do know that leucodermia is what's known as, I don't know how it's pronounced, vitiligo, maybe? Vitiligo? Anyway, it's the thing that Michael Jackson has.
Vitiligo.
Okay, thank you. Where your skin gets blotchy.
When you sleep with little boys?
Different disorder that Michael Jackson has. where your skin gets all blotchy. And so, you know, it's true that his eyes, if he had that condition, his eyes might have less protective pigment and they may be more sensitive to light because there has been some overlap with leucodermia. Kids with leucodermia have been shown to have certain optical problems, but they're problems. They're not benefits. Nobody with leucodermia suddenly has the ability to see in the dark. And so the interesting thing in the article is they say that his eyes are therefore more sensitive to light. And if you look at people who have these problems with their eyes, they are more sensitive to light. But it's in the way that what they mean is that they're more sensitive so they can't really be out in the sun because it hurts them quite badly. And so they can't be out in the sun. They can't be in direct light. And also their night vision is usually one of the first things to be affected by this disorder. So the sun is trying to get away with saying it's this condition and therefore it's more sensitive to light and therefore he can see in the dark, which is the complete opposite of what would happen. So, I mean, it's pretty much BS on every level. And, you know, these are the people who just brought us the city of Atlantis being discovered by Google Ocean with backup from Patrick Duffy and Plato. Yeah. So it's not really that big of a surprise that it's BS. But I did a Google search. I found it repeated all over the internet. You know, people are spreading around like, wow, isn't this amazing? Look at this kid with cat eyes. When in fact, when you look at it, the more likely, you know, conclusion is that maybe the family's making it up, or maybe the journalist is making it up, or maybe the doctors are making it up. There's really no evidence to suggest that this kid has, you know, supernatural cat eyes.
Yeah. Why let a perfectly good fairy tale go to waste?
So they have to let Bat Boy and Cat Boy do a cage match.
I would love to see that. Yeah. And it's funny, in my blog post, I included a picture of the Weekly World News with Bat Boy on the front. Bat Boy discovered in cave.
I bet 400 quatloos on Cat Boy.
Okay. I don't know, man. Bat Boy's been around the block.
I just want to know why Bat Boy always has his mouth open when they take pictures of him.
I love
you
Bad Boy.
I think they would have had a better story if that kid was at least bitten by a radioactive cat.
Yeah. Right.
That's a good point, Bob.
Mm. Yeah.
Would have made a good, better comic book. That's for sure.
Well, let's go on to some of your questions in email. The first question comes from Matt Alex from Minneapolis, and Matt writes, I realize this may be the in the running for the stupidest question ever asked on the show, if you leave out Neil Adams, that is, but I was watching second Austin Powers movie and started wondering about this. In the movie, Dr. Evil is threatening President Tim Robbins. President Robbins desperately wishes to be able to use a nuke against Dr. Evil, who is based on the moon. A military official asks if the president is seriously suggesting blowing up the moon. President Robbins asks the assembled group if they would miss it if it were gone. All that leads to my question. Would we miss the moon if it did not exist? I'm not asking what crazy improbable situation would be needed to remove the moon, just what the observable differences upon the Earth would be if there were no moon. Obviously, there would be tidal differences, but would we have any other major effects I'm not aware of? Please advise Jay that I will be severely disappointed if this question does not generate a Dr. Evil impression or at least a bad English accent.
You know, my first comment on this is...
It is close to us.
For those of you over the age of 35, we'll send a link as to what that actually is.
On first blush, we wouldn't have tides.
Well, that's not true. Yeah.
Okay, so
we would have tides because we have solar tides, and they would be about half as big as they are.
Yeah, half
now.
The size.
Actually,
though.
Yeah, that's what I meant. We would have.
Actually, they would be about one third. They'd be about one third as big.
Exactly. You're right, Bob.
And also,
be one third.
Bob,
I
read half. You read third.
I read a third. So
I guess it depends on how lined up the sun and the moon are, right? I mean, we wouldn't have the biggest tides where, like the Neap and Spring tides, where the sun and the moon are lined up, either on the same or opposite sides of the Earth. That synergistic effect would go away.
Right. So
that's right.
So
yeah.
the tides would be much simpler than they are now.
Yeah.
It'd be just high and they'd be low. And that's, you'd have, I assume there'd be next to no variation because there'd be no synergistic effect between the moon and the Earth. So, I mean, the sun and the Earth and the moon. So there would be a tide and it would be tiny.
And what about the speed of the rotation of the Earth? Isn't that affected by the moon?
Well,
yep,
it drags on the Earth, doesn't it?
Well, this is what would happen. Yes, the tidal breaking has been causing a slowdown of the spinning of the Earth, which has increased the day from 6 hours to our currently in vogue 24-hour day. So, but the thing is, yes, it would make a difference because the lengthening of our day would slow down. It would not stop because you would still have the tidal breaking from the Earth's sun system. So we would still be slowing down a bit, but it would be much, much more slow than it is right now.
You know what else would slow down? What other kind of rotational phenomenon?
The axis tilt?
Not the tilt. The tilt would... We'll get to that in a second, but what else would slow down is the precession of the equinoxes.
The equinoxes. Ah. Yeah. Oh, that's mediated by the moon?
Yes, that's because of the dragging effect of the moon. If the moon were not there, there would still be an effect from the sun and the other planets, but it would be much less, and therefore the equinoxes would precess instead of every 26,000 years, they would precess over hundreds of thousands or maybe even millions of years.
Wow.
Okay, that's interesting because I looked at a lot of websites. Nobody mentioned that. That's good. I'm glad I know that.
And quickly for background, the precession of the equinoxes is the movement of the Earth where the direction in which the axis is pointing moves around in a circle every 26,000 years. It's exactly like the way a top that is spinning, a spinning top, moves around in a circle as it spins.
The other change would be the rotational axis of the Earth. Now, we know the seasons are caused by the 23.5-degree tilt of the Earth, but that's not really a stable situation for planets without moons. If you look at Mars, the axis of Mars has been jumps around over the, you know, over the millennia and the millions of years. There is evidence, I believe, of the of even the polar caps on Mars being, you know, near the equator.
Yes.
So the moon, it turns out, is a great stabilizer. Without the moon, we would see our axis would change from, it could go down to 5 degrees up
to 40
more. Degrees. Yeah. We could even find ourselves, as one website put it, we could find ourselves on our back, kind of like Uranus, where we would be
rolling around
90 degrees. You know, it would be the same as our orbit around the sun itself. So our rotation would be truly odd. But the thing is that this wobble, according to some websites I looked at, they claim that this wobble would take thousands or hundreds of thousands of years to occur.
Right.
So this isn't something that you'd have, you know, hold on to the tree in your front yard so you don't go flying around.
Yeah, some sites I read, Bob, said that that may have had an effect on the stability or the ability of complex life forms to evolve. But, you know, would that really have a more dramatic effect than, say, continental drift? I mean, continental drift moves continents from warm to cold climates and back, so...
Now you're talking about if the moon never was there, right?
Yeah, right.
So, like, all right, so that's kind of a bit of a shift. That's
so
kind
yeah,
of
not
a bit
if
of
we
shift
blew it up
talking about
now.
If it disappeared. Yeah. But
as opposed to the Space 1999 scenario where it gets...
Yeah, right. but Steve, if it was never here, I think the effects would be...
They'd be more dramatic.
They'd be very dramatic. First of all, we would have incredible winds because if the Earth would be spinning faster, our day would only be 8 hours long if the moon had never existed.
Mm-hmm.
The day would have increased by only 2 hours, from 6 hours to an 8 hour day because of the sun's tidal breaking. So the winds, our daily winds could be like 100 miles an hour, and the hurricane winds, forget it. They could be really nasty. Yeah, the only other real huge impact would be evolution. I think it's pretty clear that we would not be here, and evolution would be greatly impacted if we didn't have a moon, because you'd have widely changing climates, which would, if you evolve to for an environment at the equator, and then, you know, thousands of years later you're at the poles.
Would it be that quick? Would it just be over thousands of years?
Well, one guy was saying that it could be thousands or hundreds of thousands of years.
Right.
So, you know, in the Earth, that's not much time on Earth for species evolution. So you'd have to adapt or migrate or something. But the other thing, though, Steve, is that, remember, when the moon was first formed, it was 10 to 20 times closer to the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
The tides were absolutely mountainous mounds of like 10,000 foot high mountains
really?
Of water. And
wow.
What they literally scoured the earth and just dragged everything back into the ocean, into the primordial soup, and enriched it with all the different minerals and elements that it took from the land. And that really helped create the primordial soup. So some people argue that without the moon to do that, evolution would have taken much, much longer to happen, because then you'd only have, say, the rivers would be enriching the oceans, and that's
right.
Much more slow occurrence than
oh, there was still there was still some
tides.
Solar tides, as we said, as well.
Yeah, yeah, but no, they would be
but nothing compared to what
nothing compared
the
to what the moon was
right.
doing.
So there'd be a lot of interesting changes if the moon suddenly disappeared right now. But if it happened at this point in time, we would go on.
I mean, every effect I could find. Pointed to nothing really dramatic. It would really not affect, you know, an average person's life in
yeah.
any significant way. And I don't know if there was one other subtle one, Steve, that you might not have heard of that would be noticeable, but it would still be kind of subtle. Apparently there's the water in the ocean would redistribute itself to a certain degree. If the moon disappeared, the
so
poles
our coastlines would be redefined.
Yeah, they would to a certain degree, but apparently the poles would a lot more water would go towards the poles than there is there now. So that would be noticeable,
mm-hmm.
but it was hard to get a handle on how intense
right.
that effect would be.
Right.
But it is another effect, and there was an even more subtle one. Apparently, the moon is somehow related to the Pacific's El Nino, so there's some subtle interaction going on there that would be noticeable, but really only by scientists, probably not by
right.
the average guy.
Oh, so the Earth would lose its bulge in the middle if the moon were gone?
No, we'd still be an oblate spheroid. That's really just the rotation of the Earth. But yeah, the water would redistribute itself a little bit.
Well, thanks for that question, Matt. And by coincidence, we have another moon-related question also from another Matt. This is Matt from London who asks us, "Hi, guys, avid fan of the show, et cetera, et cetera. Question for you. Sure, there is a super easy answer, but I have never heard it yet. So here goes. What are the odds that from our perspective on Earth, the moon and sun appear exactly the same size? The two bodies are unrelated apart from our looking at them. Interesting. Be great to hear your comments." An interesting question. I actually had a creationist throw that in my face as evidence that the Earth was created. Said, what are the odds that the sun and the moon would have the same apparent size from the Earth? Handiwork of G.O.D.
There you go.
I disagree.
I disagree that this is an easy question. To me, this reminds me a little bit of the Drake equation, because I think there's lots of separate elements that you'd have to add to this equation.
Yeah.
Like, what are the odds of, a planet creating or capturing a moon that's outside the Roche limit so that it actually stays in orbit and it's not tidal forces don't rip it apart, that the planet's the right distance from the sun, that intelligent life evolves on the planet, and that life exists during a time when the angular size is the same. So these are separate components that I think it's hard, like the Drake equation, it'd be hard to give a real figure to each of these. But I did try to work on one of them, that last one.
Before you do that, Bob, can I just clarify one thing?
Okay.
That one of the premises of Matt's question is that the Earth and the Moon appeared exactly the same size. And to clarify, the Moon and the Sun both have a variable apparent size based upon the distance of the Earth from the Moon and the distance of the Earth from the Sun. And so it's a range. The apparent size is a range. And those ranges do overlap, but they're not identical. So it's not really accurate to say that they have exactly the same size. They have different ranges that do have a portion that overlaps.
Yeah, that's an
and that, of course,
point.
Dramatically raises the odds. So the real question is, what are the chances of two celestial bodies, like a sun and a moon, having ranges of apparent sizes that overlap? It would be the way to ask it.
Well, this is how I approached that last component of what are the odds of an intelligent life existing during a time when the apparent size is so close. And I could be wrong, maybe I'm wrong, but my odds were 50-50. Tell me what you think of my equations, if this makes any sense. Homo sapiens have been around for, say, 400,000 years, okay? And according to what I was able to ascertain, that we have about a little bit under a billion years until we could see that last eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
And the way this was figured out, I believe, was that once the moon can only cover 98% of the sun, that it would not be dark. It wouldn't be during an eclipse. It wouldn't be dark outside. So it's not really appropriate to call it a perfect eclipse anymore, because it wouldn't even get dark outside in a billion years. So at that point, we could say, you could argue that, all right, it's not a real eclipse anymore and the sizes aren't close enough anymore. So that's a billion years. So if you add those two figures together, you get really just under a billion years that a human could see eclipses. Okay, so you follow that?
Mm-hmm.
It's about a billion years when a human could actually see an eclipse. Now, how long would humans actually see the moon itself, regardless of the distance? So you got the 400,000 years since Homo sapiens have been around, and then you've got about 2 billion years from today, and then Earth is uninhabitable. So, some websites I went to said that in about 2 billion years, it's going to be so hot that Earth will be uninhabitable. So you've got a range of about a little over 2 billion years that humans could potentially have actually just look up in the sky and see a moon. Okay, so that's 2 billion compared to 1 million. 1 billion years Homo sapiens can see a full eclipse, and 2 billion years that humans could see the moon. So that's 50-50 for that piece of the equation anyway. Does that make any sense?
I read an interesting thing in New Scientist, and what it said was basically that with the moon moving away from us at about 3.8 centimeters per year,
Right.
You can consider 200 million years ago, when the dinosaurs were wandering around, they didn't see eclipses like we did because the moon
right.
was too close and it was more than big enough to block out the whole sun. During 100 million years' time, if humans are still around, they won't see any total eclipses at all because the moon will be too small. So when you say a billion years, it's actually much, much smaller of a gap than that.
The figures that we start with were different. The figures that my equations came from were smaller than yours, like say 2 centimeters a year, and you use 3.8. So yeah, so it depends on whose figures are more accurate. So yeah, if your figures are accurate, then yeah, it would be less than a billion years.
Well, I don't mean to side with New Scientist over you, Bob.
No, New Scientist. That's a good resource. I'll have to check my sources again and see how reliable they are.
Yeah, I checked around. The 3.8 centimeters per year figure seems to be the most often cited. However, that's probably not the rate at which the moon was moving away from the Earth in the past. And there I found conflicting information, some sides saying that it was moving away even faster in the past because the tides were bigger, another side saying that it was moving away slower because the tides were less efficient at transferring energy, and that had to do with the arrangement of the continents. But the bottom line is, just for the Earth Moon, sun system, there's a huge expanse of time, hundreds of millions of years, where the apparent size of the sun and the moon are going to overlap. So that's a long opportunity in terms of mankind's time on Earth. But what are the odds that we would have a moon at all that was, appropriately sized? And of the appropriate size and distance where its apparent size would overlap with our sun.
Those other factors in the moon Drake equation analog. You're right. Those other elements to the equation, they're much more difficult to figure out and greatly decreases the odds. But who can put a real solid figure to it?
And from another point of view, that may not even be the right question. So like with my creationist friend who wanted to know what are the odds that the Earth and the Moon and the Sun would have the same apparent size. He's making the lottery fallacy. He's not asking the right question. The real question is, what are the odds that there would be some, coincidence or anomaly in anything, that you could point to in the natural world that you could then point to and say there's evidence of, that's too great a coincidence to have occurred naturally. It must be the handiwork of God. That's again what we call anomaly hunting, and it's also the use of open-ended criteria, right? I mean, there's nothing specific about the sun and the moon having the same apparent size that points to a supernatural agency. It's just a quirky coincidence that you're pointing out. But what are the chances that there would be anything like that that you could point to? That's a much broader question. Again, it's the difference between what's the chance of somebody winning the lottery versus the chance of John Smith winning the lottery.
Right. The law of truly large numbers.
Right.
There's bound to be some freaky stuff going on when you got so many different interacting variables and discrete events occurring at the same time.
And now, Randy speaks.
Good morning, afternoon, or night, depending on where you are. I'm James Randi. A few words about parapsychologists that may better inform you about this peculiar subspecies of Homo sapiens. They exhibit strange characteristics, one of which is overconfidence. Most of these parascientists are grandly soothed and confident when surrounded with enough misapplied technology. And when it reflects regular, recognized lab procedures well enough, it brings them great comfort. They freely use electronic systems that would provide useful data in the hands of real researchers, and displays of these bells and whistles lend an atmosphere of authenticity that can encourage acceptance and funding from observers who don't venture or even care to grab the cheesecloth. I must explain. That term refers to the material used by spirit mediums in earlier days, a thin fabric sometimes treated with luminous compounds that in a darkened room produced the illusion of ectoplasm, a theoretical substance formed from the bodies of spirits that they summoned up. Grabbing the cheesecloth was just that. seizing this prop and retaining it as further proof of the deception. There are a few examples of parapsychologists I'd like to give you. Dr. Gary E. Schwartz is the University of Arizona's professor of psychology, surgery, medicine, neurology, and psychiatry, as well as director of their Center for Frontier Medicine in Biofield Science, and of their Veritas Research Program of the Laboratory for Advances in Consciousness and Health. He carefully festooned the head of I Talk to the Dead artist John Edward with varicolored cables, very much as in an EKG, just as if the chimerical signs he sought originated in that performer's encephalon. Those wires should have been stuck to his own skull, where the great naive force was actually being so generously manifested. Dr. Jacques Benveniste, in the comfortable atmosphere of his lab in Clamart, France, was comforted by error bars between which his cursor obediently wandered, when it was simply a lack of double-blind precautions that impelled him to publish his imaginary data. In my forthcoming book, A Magician in the Laboratory, I'll be devoting an entire chapter to this classic adventure in frustration. Consider the very handsomely funded Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab, PEAR, where they carried out coin-tossing experiments in which normally expected variances were misinterpreted as significant deviations from this very basic on or off, up or down, yes or no flip-flop operation, the very simplicity and elegance of which had them enchanted and thoroughly deceived. This lab, too, will be a major subject of my book. Ghost hunters with overtuned meters, probes, antenna, thermocouples, digital cameras, and hundreds of pounds of equipment that they just don't understand read into every faint burp or squeak of signal heavy significance. They, too, call this science. But all this makes for great TV, and sponsors love it, I can tell you. Teller, of Penn and Teller fame, has a startling illusion in which a handful of coins he has materialized from thin air, wherever that is, suddenly becomes a school of goldfish flashing about in a large aquarium. This, understandably, evokes gasps from the audience. Now, it's not reaching too far to imagine the parascientists hooking Teller up to a chart recorder via a set of leads to read his skin conductivity, transparency, and resistance at the instant when the brilliant specialized carp manifest in the water. They would call this research, but as usual, they would learn nothing, would not solve the trick, and would have to assert that it was paranormal, that is, outside normal science, much to the mixed amusement and chagrin of the conjuring trade, who pay taxes to support such idiocy, as all of us do. A word about that paranormal term. There's no such thing as bad science. It's either science or it's not. The word paranormal was used by Duke University's Dr. Joseph Banks Rhine to designate what he thought he'd discovered: extrasensory perception and psychokinesis, ESP and PK, that existed in a special category beyond orthodox science with no explanations in science. But the possibility exists and is eagerly pursued even today in the woo-woo labs that real science and this chimera could be reconciled. Rhine engaged in endless dice-tossing tests and even more endless card-guessing marathons and imagined tiny, barely significant margins of data that were later shown to be at least partly due to misrecording and outright error. But it was the live performances of tricksters that validated, for him and for so many others who followed him, the possible trace significance he'd celebrated. Rhine was effectively and easily fooled by such performers because he was convinced, as all parapsychologists are even today, that he couldn't be fooled. In other words, he was the perfect foil for a magic trick. When he came up with words that sounded scientific, were properly derived, and carried the imprimatur of academia, a new pseudoscience was born. And it has grown into a monster. I'm James Randi. Until next time, keep asking questions and stay skeptical.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week's items?
I am so ready.
Roger.
You'll be happy to know.
Sometimes you come up with four.
Sometimes. Okay. But you'll be happy to know that there's no theme this week.
Yay.
Yeah.
And you guys,
that makes me happy.
That's awesome, Steve.
Not.
Here we go. Item number one. Review of data indicates that 2008 was the coolest year in the last three decades. Item number two, a new study reveals that the risk of serious blood clots increases up to fourfold from long airline flights. And item number three, new research indicates that television viewers enjoy programs more when they are interrupted by commercials. Bob, go first.
I know that 2008, I mean, I haven't read anything recently on this, but I know that 2008 was cooler than the few years before that. Because remember 2007, 2005, they were like, oh man, this is the hottest year in decades. But I know, so 2008 was a little cooler, but in three decades, in 30 years, oh man, that's pushing it. Blood clots increasing fourfold, that to me, that makes perfect sense, too much sense, because I know that blood clot, the risk for blood clots are great when you're completely inactive. You know, even for a 2 hour car ride, they say, you know, stop the car every, you know, half hour at least if you're especially prone. So yeah, I mean, you go into Australia, you're going to be on that plane for 10, 15, 20 hours, fourfold increase. I could see that easily. And the third one, that was the commercials. People, what was it? People enjoy shows more when there's commercials? What the hell? How could that possibly be? I think that's meant to just totally screw with us. So let's see, between the coolest year in decades or the commercial one, three decades, 30 years. The commercials is too obvious. I guess I'll go with the coolest year.
Okay, Jay?
I'm really not agreeing with the 2008 being the coolest year, because that was a pretty shitty year.
He doesn't mean it in a metaphorical sense.
A new study reveals that the risk of serious blood clots increase up to fourfold from long airline flights. Yeah, I've heard about that. Fourfold seems a lot. New research indicates that television viewers enjoy programs more when they are interrupted by commercials. That's very strange. Okay. I'm going to say that the blood clots is the fake.
Okay, Evan?
I'll start with the blood clots. I think that's entirely correct. And I'm not surprised that new studies, that they're studying this more and they're realizing that the risk is even greater than previously anticipated. I think there's a very logical correlation there, and I believe that that one is science. Jumping around a bit, over to the television viewers enjoying programs more when they're interrupted by commercials. I thought about this, and I thought this one was fiction, but I think when there are commercials, that gives people a chance to, you know, get up, stretch their legs, go to the bathroom, get something to eat, get something to drink. I think that contributes, perhaps, to their overall enjoyment of the program more.
Just pause your TiVo.
So I have a feeling that that one's correct, and therefore all that I'm left with is 2008 being the coolest year the last three decades. Sounds good, but I just don't think that one's right. So I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, I'll be honest, Steve. You've kind of stumped me here, because I am pretty sure that 2008 was one of the coolest years in recent times, but last three decades, I can't tell you. I don't know. Serious blood clots increasing fourfold. That makes sense. I can understand that. I don't know about the fourfold figure, but I'm sure that blood clots do increase on long airline flights. And it does make sense that people, at first it seems ridiculous that viewers would like programs more when they're interrupted but that's so ridiculous that I don't think you would have made that up. Must be true. And maybe, you know, people are more interested in commercial or in programs when they're interrupted because they have short attention spans, and it kind of increases the entertainment value of the show, makes it more interesting. So I don't know. The thing that leaves the most room for doubt, I think, is the idea that 2008 was the coolest year in the last three decades, because there are a number of things that I'm not too sure on there. So I'm going to go with that one. But this is a very good chunk of options, because I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, let's start with the commercial, since you all agree that that one's correct. You all think that new research indicates that television viewers enjoy programs more when they are interrupted by commercials. You all seriously think that people like being interrupted by commercials?
No.
Given the three choices.
No, yes. It's not that they like being interrupted by commercials. That would be ridiculous, but that's not the question you asked.
That you're correct. You're right. That one is science. And in this research, people did not enjoy the commercials, but they enjoyed the programs they were watching better when they were interrupted by commercials. And I think pretty much Rebecca and Evan hit upon the reason for that. It is that people have a short attention span, or it's actually not so much the attention span per se, is that they habituate to the show that they're watching. The jokes are not as funny over time, and whatever is interesting or cool about the show, they just habituate to it, so it just is not as interesting. And when it's interrupted, it kind of rekindles their interest in the show.
Yeah, so if you stop watching, like, Two and a Half Men or Everybody Loves Raymond or whatever, then, you know, it probably wouldn't have that much of a difference on you. But
right,
if you get those shows where they say basically the same joke over and over and over again, that the commercials probably help.
Yeah, in fact, that's true also, that this effect is only true for certain kinds of programs, but specifically sitcoms. Mm-hmm. It's also true for animations, documentaries, and music videos, but they said it probably would not be true for a show like 24, which is so fast-paced and action-filled that you don't need commercial interruptions to stay on the edge of your seat. But mindless sitcoms, yes, commercials actually enhance your viewing pleasure. Very interesting.
Yeah, I agree, because just a couple times that we missed 24, so we just downloaded them from Amazon onto the TV. And man, it's great because there's no commercials. You just fly through that show, and you're not bored at all.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Here's another point I learned many years ago. I don't know if this is still true. This goes back a couple decades from my high school years. We're taught that in Europe, most programming was done without commercial breaks. You know, you got your 25 minutes of programs and then 5 minutes of solid commercials after that, and
right,
then you go into the next program. And whereas that's never been, as far as I recall, the case in America. There's always been commercial interruptions.
Well, network television.
Just about everything. Network television.
Right.
Yeah, but even cable too.
No, not like HBO though, like premium channels. And if you watch everything online like I do.
Right.
True.
Well, let's take these in reverse order. Number two, a new study reveals that the risk of serious blood clots increases up to fourfold from long airline flights. That one is science.
Yay.
Science.
That was kind of the most obvious one. And I guess the only thing to really call that into doubt was whether fourfold was accurate or not. And it was. Not a surprise, as Bob said, you know, sitting for a long period of time does increase the risk of forming deep vein thrombosis, or blood clots in the veins, especially in the legs. And this is especially true for people who are susceptible, specifically if you're overweight, for example. And just the inactivity of having to sit in one place is enough to increase the risk of clots forming. Of course, the danger is that those clots can break off and they can go to the lungs and cause a pulmonary embolism.
Can we change the subject already? I'm done talking about this.
About pulmonary embolisms?
Wow.
That's
because we've been sitting here for 2 hours doing this.
I know. Right. The subject makes me really uncomfortable.
But the good news is the increased awareness of this can actually be a very effective preventive. As Bob said, the easy way to prevent it is to move around. Now, if you are, for whatever reason, restricted and you can't literally get up and walk around, you can just flex your calves and that has a sufficient effect, you know, to ward off the blood clots forming. So, and often I actually do that. Like, I'm sitting on a plane for more than a couple hours, I make a point to just, you know, flex my calf muscles every now and then, just to keep the venous stasis from...
Keep your what?
Venous stasis.
Oh, okay.
You know Venus.
Venus. From,
okay. Next.
From forming blood clots.
Steve, how much of a risk is
no,
that?
No, please don't draw this out. I've really, please.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely increases it for with lots of ailments. You know, so it's like a young, healthy, you know, person would have a pretty small risk, but you might as well make it smaller if it's as easy as flexing.
So, Steve, this increases the size of your venous?
Now I'm really uncomfortable. Can we move on?
Well, let's move on. So that means that review of data indicates that 2008 was the coolest year in the last three decades is fiction.
It was the rockiest year for me, though.
It is fantasy.
Yes. However, it was the coolest year since 2000.
That's what I...
Right. So that was obviously why I was hoping to snag you on that. So, but not in the last three decades. In fact, it was still the ninth warmest year on record.
Ouch.
Okay. Wow. Very interesting.
So even though it may have taken a local dip, you know, over the last 9 years, it is still we're still in a relatively warm period since we've been keeping track of these things, which goes back to, you know, how far?
1400s?
1880.
1880, yeah.
Yeah. We've been keeping annual data like this for since 1880. So since then, it's still the ninth warmest year on record. And this probably has something to do with the solar cycle. You know, so there's multiple climate trends, one of which is, you know, the 11-year solar cycle, and we are hitting a negative in 2008, which may have led to the relative decrease in temperature.
Bit of a cooling, yeah.
So good job, everyone, but Jay.
I mean,
Yeah.
Who's that noisy? Who's that noisy?
So tell us who won last week's Who's That Noisy?
All right. Well, first I'm going to play it back for you guys because it's been a couple weeks since you've actually heard it.
When I go into a home, I'm not looking for devils. I'm not looking for ghosts. What I'm looking for is a natural explanation as to what's going on. Something physical in the house. Only when I find that there is something supernatural, something paranormal, do I accept it. And that has to be proven to me 100%. Mm-hmm. I have to see a table moving across the room.
And I'll be shocked if you guys didn't
get
who that
obviously
was.
A hardcore skeptic right there.
Yes, that's James Randi. And
it sounds like a young Ed Warren.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, ding, ding, ding.
That's why I asked you how old the clip was last time, but you didn't tell me.
No, I didn't tell you.
That guy was such a jerk.
Too much away. Oh, gosh. Got to talk to them like they're on a third grade level. That's an Ed Warren quote.
He also said, yes. Science is boring. He did.
Can you imagine?
When I walk into a house, I don't expect to see.
It's funny because it's true.
Ed.
Oh, no.
He was a character.
So Ed Warren, tell our listeners who Ed Warren is, if there's
briefly.
Still anybody out there who doesn't know.
One of the most world-famous, quote-unquote, ghost hunters, who happened to reside here in Connecticut, along with his lovely, lovely wife, Lorraine, the two of them would team up and go investigate haunted houses, such as the Amityville Horror House,
right.
for famous example. Oh, wait, that was a hoax.
Don't.
You know, Ed and Lorraine couldn't pick up on that. Yeah. Basically, anything you put in front of Ed and Lorraine Warren, they believed it wholesale.
They're like the crazy, credulous grandparents I never had.
Yeah.
But they wrote books, and they toured, and they would be on television shows.
They spun off
they
about
a million
ghost hunting groups in New England.
They made all their money off of that.
Yeah.
In any case, our friend Henning from the boards was the first
Doug?
One to correctly identify that as Ed Warning.
Warren.
Well, just Henning.
Oh.
H-E-N-N-I-N-G.
It's magic.
That's great.
Congratulations,
Henning.
Great.
Okay,
now,
next.
What's this week's?
Here we go for this week's, all right? Here it comes.
I know that. That's the intro to 5x5, right?
Who's that noisy?
Who's that noisy?
Good luck, everyone.
Who's that noisy?
Interesting.
Well, enjoy.
Thank you, Evan.
Anytime.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes, I do. I have a quote sent in by a listener named Michael Vag. This is a quote by Galileo. And Galileo said, "Long experience has taught me this about the status of mankind with regard to matters requiring thought. The less people know and understand about them, the more positively they attempt to argue concerning them. While on the other hand, to know and understand a multitude of things renders men cautious and passing judgment upon anything new." Galileo!
Yay!
Oh, that's good stuff.
Good quote. That's a good quote.
Good man.
Galileo Galilei.
I have an announcement thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a very special Boston Skeptics in the Pub coming up. On
how special?
Oh, very special. I'd give it a 9 on a scale of 1 to 10.
Cool. 9.
Normally we have it at the end of the month, but this time it's going to be March 16th, which is Monday. And our guest will be William Lobdell, who wrote a book called Losing My Religion. He was a religion correspondent for the LA Times, and then he became an atheist. It's a fascinating story. And we're going to be at the Tommy Doyle's in Kendall Square. Kendall Square.
A very quick announcement about the website. The improvements and tweaks and fixes are still underway. There were a lot of problems with the RSS feed, but we went through that, the entire RSS, and I think all of the glitches were fixed. But if you encounter a problem downloading one particular episode, let us know. If it's a problem with the RSS, we'll fix it quickly.
TAM7 registration is now open. Go to randy.org and you can register. We're going to be there. It's going to be awesome. We'll talk about it more later, but do it. Do it now.
Do it July 9th to 12th. Yes. In Las Vegas, again, we'll have a more thorough discussion of it. Maybe we'll bring Phil on to chat about it in the next week or two. But just a quick heads up: registration open for TAM7. So,
and we will all be there.
Well, thank you guys for joining me again this week.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
Sure,
this was a lot of fun.
Good
a lot
times.
Of fun this week.
Good times,
Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.